John Hannigan's here.
Yeah, so what?
So, that's
happy holidays to you, too.
That is a damn good question, though.
Yeah.
I am a miserable human being. You know that.
You know, I love you anyway.
Thank you, John.
Then I probably shouldn't say that Scott is here, too.
It's Scott, the person who set the record for the latest mission to CFAT.
You know, somebody got into a lot of trouble over that, the person who was responsible for that. They got demoted.
Really?
No, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to be responsible.
No, it was your fault. It was, we fought with them about this, and this person, you know, was insistent, and then our manager took it up to, because our grants manager used to work in that office, so she knows everybody, and so she took it up to the whoever's in charge over there, and they took that person off of grants and put her in somewhere else.
Oh no! So, you grants are.
Yeah, it was a mistake.
Well, I don't know.
It must have been the final straw.
Yeah, I think that was the thing. I think that's what our person
said.
That's what
I'm going to tell myself to be able to sleep at night, Scott.
That they've been having trouble with her before.
Jill worries about all this type of stuff. And, you know, I just kind of,
She's the brains and I'm the heart. That's how it works.
You are the heart.
Yes, well, I'm...
You're also the perseverative person.
This is also true. I am from Wisconsin, and I ruminate.
You just perseverate. You like to send emails.
You're in this dream world where every time I try to talk to you in person, you say, just email me, and then you complain about emails.
But you know I love you, so it's all right.
All right. We'll start our one-man show to Broadway.
Oh, Helen's on, right?
Yes, I'm here. I'm just on mute. Thank you.
You've done a great job.
Oh, thank you.
Need to be acknowledged today. Trying to get an update on this thing. And I'm having trouble with my computer, obviously. Yeah. All right, so Jill, can you take a roll call and see who we have and who we don't have? Why I try to find this, because...
No problem.
I really want to report on it today.
Okay, so Ed is on. Dr. Charnas? Okay, how about Dr. Jones?
I'm here.
Hi, Dr. Jones.
Hi, Jill.
And then I know Scott's on, because we participated in getting someone fired and demoted. Elizabeth Sowell?
Yeah.
Good morning. Dr. Wozniak?
I'm here.
Sarah?
I'm here.
Oh, hi, Sarah. Tatiana? No Tatiana. Dr. Hammond?
I'm here, Jill.
Hi. All
right.
Dr. Eberhardt, hopefully?
I'm here, yes.
Okay. And then I've been speaking with Joanne, so I know she's here. Dr. Donaldson?
Jill, hi. Well, you've elevated me far beyond my stature. No doctor, but I am here.
I did do that. I'm sorry. But you should be. So Dr. Hannigan,
yep.
I know is there because he's got Scrooge entrance. And is Sarah Jo on? So Dr. Harold is on. Dr. Dunphy?
We're both here.
All right. So I know Dr. Savage was going to be a little bit late, but I think everyone else hopefully will be joining soon. Oh, Leah, are you on for Tatiana? Helen's here, I know.
All right, so who's not here? And Michael's not.
Michael and Dr. Savage will be running a little bit late, and I didn't hear Tatiana, but everyone else I think piped in.
Or Lara Jo's not here.
Right.
Sarah's not here, okay. All right, we have just a few updates. The renewal did get in. All the applications, in fact, made it in on time with 11 minutes to spare. And so that's good, I guess. We had... they're in. So everybody was accepted, right? No one's got rejected? All right. So... the call is basically about the current CPAS project. And I just want to remind people of a few things. Is that this is a repository, and we need to make sure that we get all of our data into that central repository. You have to remember that CPAS doesn't count any data that's not uploaded into the repository as really existing. If there is a data for your data in CPAS. And I was just reminded of this at the ACNP meeting. And maybe Dale or Bill knows more about this, but is NIH trying to put together a common type of database or a link to databases? Because I was asked where ours was housed, how it was housed, how people could get access to it, and whether there were possibilities to linking into our database once it was made public.
And who asked you?
Ed?
Antonio Nerona.
Oh, okay. Heard of them.
I think there is an effort across NIH to do that, and there is a renewed effort at NIAAA to do just that with some of our sister institutes. So nothing official, but I think people are just gathering information.
Okay. He just wanted to know, you know, if it was all available in a single place, whether that place was secure. In fact, it sounded like it was something that was just beginning, but mm-hmm. that some place at NIH where they store all this stuff. And I even told him that he might want to talk to Bill, because I know Indiana has the capability of storing and maintaining these databases, and an alternative to look at.
But someone sounds like they're in a wind tunnel.
It was very vague, the request, and I think, you know, he was satisfied with my answers that our data are out there, and we have published or sent out things that the data are available. We have a way for them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, with Antonio, you never know what's really going on. So, but just to remind people that they need to get their data uploaded into the database. It seems that it's something that NIH is really sincere about, and failure to comply with that probably is not the best idea.
Is there a way that we can ensure that that's happening? I mean, how do we know that all the counting that you started with what's being counted, but I think there's also a bigger issue. So how do we handle making sure that we're in compliance?
Well, we can look at Google Docs and see a discrepancy between Google Docs and what's in the database. But it will not be a simple task.
No. And it's different for different projects. I mean, every project has a different...
So right now what I'm going to do is really depend upon people to be honest about it and to make sure that they get their data in there as much as possible. Because 3 months from now, Antonio may say, hey, I want to see what your database looks like.
Right.
And, you know, so we all have grants. and the independent of CFAS, and those grants are run through various divisions at NIAAA. And obviously we want to be in compliance, and we want to make everybody at NIAAA happy. So if there is a database available for your data, it should be up to date, and the Google Doc should correspond to what's in the database.
Ed, I've got a question. It seems to me, I recall that there have been some requests for data sharing.
We had the problem and still have a problem with the consent that was done during phase one.
Okay.
And that's...
But that's not going to go away, right?
Well, it's not going to go away without someone taking an effort to make it go away.
Okay.
And there are ways that one can do this in an anonymous fashion, and then have us recapitulate the data, or to have a collaborator in CFAS who basically would put the data back together after it was analyzed, so that there would be no identifiable information. And at least that is what I found out about doing that. So that's where we are with that.
Okay, thanks.
The other thing I want to do is and maybe Helen has a better update, but on November 28th, I believe, NOFAS in its, what do they call it, their weekly, they put out a kind of a weekly update, a newsletter.
Roundup?
Yeah, the NOFAS Roundup. They put on a mention of a volunteer for the CFAS research study. And let's see if I can find it here real quick. It simply said that new registry will connect researchers to families and individuals living with FASD. And it says we're recruiting volunteers to take part in our study, and we invite people of all ages to register on there. And they are basically consenting to be contacted for any future studies. And I think that we have, after only a few days, we had over 50 people register. Helen, do you have any update on that?
No, unfortunately not that many. We started extremely nice. You know, the first week we acquired almost 3 people per day. But at this point, we have 28 records, and people still come in. I don't know, maybe it's not that easy to find right now.
Right.
Because, you know, like when it just came, it was just right there on the page. And I'm afraid that right now it's a little bit hidden. So I know that the person who is a web developer at NOFAS, he's on vacation right now. So I hope, you know, when he's back, we're going to put it in the more visible space. But at this moment, we have 28 records and 21 people who actually said that they can be contacted. And I just wanted to point out that we have people from Canada as well.
Right.
Here. So at this point, we have 4 records.
Well, I thought that the response, given the fact that it's not very well advertised, NOFAS is the only one who put this out, and they put it out one time. And then it's also on their web page, I believe.
It's on the, yes, it is on the web page.
I'm sending the link to everyone right now.
But we did get, after it first came out in the NOFAS newsletter, we did get a large surge of, you know, well, relatively large surge. We then made a modification where we sent a response back to those people thanking them and asking them to also
tell other friends. And then I guess yesterday or the day before, I got like four more that came in. So there is a registry up, and we just have to basically advertise it now. And when I sent in the new proposal for CFAS, the admin core, we had, I think, four letters of support from organizations that said they would advertise this registry or this list of people who, it's not really a registry, but who are willing to volunteer. So hopefully we can make this more available to people and get out the word after the holidays. I think starting now is just people have other things going on with the holidays and they're probably too busy to do it. So rather than bombard them several times, I think we'll just wait till after the new year and then get all those people to that have agreed to send this out to send it out. Does that make sense?
Could it be tweeted? Sorry, I just Peter. Could it be tweeted?
If I knew how to tweet, that's a possibility. I have never tweeted anyone in my life, so but I'm sure NoFAS knows how to tweet, and we could get that out.
Hey, Ed, this is Tom. I would add that we're going to run that again in the roundup today, and we have a call later in the week with our affiliates in which we will be walking them through adding a link to the homepage of their websites. And we'll add it to the NoFAS website. As Helen mentioned, Andy Ketcher, who's our communications person, has been out of the country for a couple of weeks. But we'll also, we've got about 8,000-9,000 people on social media. We haven't reached out to them yet. We will be doing that later this week and then into the new year.
Yeah. Like I said, it's very, very limited, you know, distribution so far. And I was pleased. I mean, I'm just hoping to get a couple hundred. And, you know, the basis of this is that so people know about us, can sign up for these things, and then we can start doing the types of studies that we want to do on a more widespread basis. But
do you have questions on the registry to ask them how they found out about us so we can kind of know what's most effective?
Well, right now I think we just get names. I don't want to keep bombarding these people with questions so they get turned off when we haven't really done anything yet except acknowledge their response.
So, Ed, the idea is people will upload their information and that information will be protected?
That information is protected. It is not available to anyone.
Okay.
The only people who will eventually be able to request contact information, and we haven't worked this out yet, are people who have an approved IRB study utilizing this type of registry. This registry idea was very confused in the CFAS application. My initial purpose was basically, I know from experience of getting a grant reviewed and getting killed on this, is that they wanted proof that we could establish such a thing and be able to recruit people through it. So what I wanted to do was to put up this volunteer research study participation thing in order to collect data for the reverse site visit. So when that question comes up, I could say through limited mail outs and things like that, we've managed to accumulate 350 names already so that we could answer that question. As part of Tatiana's project, Tatiana is going to be developing an online consent for each individual project with an approved IRB, and so I think it'll all work out really well in the end. But without pilot data, I was afraid that we would get killed on our efforts to expand our recruitment. So that's the reason it went up as rapidly as it did. And I really need to thank Bill and particularly Helen, who did an outstanding job in putting this together.
Thank you very much.
So that's that. Are there any other news that anyone wants to share? And then we'll come back to it. But we have a thing by Jeff, I believe, today, right?
Johan,
I'm sorry. I'm a little bit out of it. I will mention just a few other things. Tina's not on the call, but Tina's going back to the Ukraine in the second week in February. They had the paper published on with Rajesh on the microRNAs. They've been asked to write an article for something that they call The Conversation, which is a publication that translates science news to the public. I think that's really good. And I guess Rajesh, as a result of this, was invited to speak at another society. So, you know, I think it's all going pretty well. And hopefully we'll get a little bit play on this and press and get a lot of data out before our reverse site visit, which will occur during those early weeks in March.
We've been looking at that paper, and it's really pretty exciting, but we didn't get an early look at it. And I know that the PUBS policy had some information to prompt people to send it our way. This might have been an ideal one.
I don't know whether Rajesh is on the call, but I do know that Tina sent it in to NIAAA.
Yeah, it did make it onto the website, so
yeah.
Our press people did see it. But I don't think Dale or I saw a copy prior, or maybe it was sent to Ken. I don't know.
Yeah, and we're not trying to point fingers, but we can really get the word out if this machine works smoothly.
Is Jen on the call? All right.
Grant reviews.
Isn't there a way that when a publication goes in, that we're supposed to get it into that publication mix, and then it's supposed to go to NIAAA?
Yeah, and the online document is accessible to everyone, and I'll resend the link to NOFAS and NIAAA people so they have that, but the document should be in their Google Drive. They can see it at any time.
Could have seen it that way, but if it could be an active process on the other side,
yeah,
I agree. I agree that you two should get a copy of those papers, you know, as they're going, right after they're accepted, even if they're embargoed. At least you get a copy so that you're ready for the embargo.
That would be great.
All right. So can you please mark that down, Jill, as something?
Got it.
Jen needs to
And frequently, Dr. Kube highlights these sorts of papers. If we have them in the system and have worked them up, excuse me.
Yeah.
So, you know, your next paper might be getting a lot of reach from the director's office here.
And that is never, ever a bad thing.
Right.
Yeah, I know he recently did that for at the council meeting for Sarah's decision tree paper.
Well, I he also presented some stuff at ACNP, and CFAS was not there. So if he has that information, he gets it, you know, where Nadia was. So it's all good. But the more he knows about us, the better off we're going to be.
Most people haven't been to council, but there's a big table, and there's a lot of prominent alcohol researchers around that table that form the advisory committee, as Sarah and Ed know quite well.
Yeah, and it's council who decides on what RFAs go out and what priorities, what research sticks out for priorities. So if there's a priority research area and it has a 24 as a score and there's a 21 that's less of a priority, you could get funded. So just, so it's important, and it's important to keep it on the front burner of the director's perception. Okay. Do we want to go to the WebEx? Are there any other comments before we move forward to Johan's presentation? Okay. I'm looking at it right now.
Okay. So everyone sees it all right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I was just going to give you an update on some of the gene-ethanol interaction work that we've been doing. So here are a few genotypes that we've shown interact with alcohol. I'm going to spend mostly talking about PDGFRA and what we're learning from that, and how some of our data might be more broadly applicable to other gene environment or gene ethanol interactions, particularly as I get to an update on this guy here, Vangle 2, and then I'll tell you just a tiny bit about what my postdoc, Ben Lovely, has been doing, and he's on the job market, so if any of you know of jobs, he's looking.
I've never seen anyone apply for more jobs in my life than Ben.
He's an all-around go-getter, for sure.
Yeah.
He has a couple interviews already, so he's heading to Boston later this week, and then he's had an interview at KU and Drexel, and there's one more that I'm forgetting at the moment. But he's
very good, if anyone does know of any positions.
Yeah, he's outstanding, and he'll be taking some good mutant resources with him, too. So,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I did, but...
It's quite all right. You can interrupt any time. So first off, one of the real exciting things, and it's really, really preliminary, so I don't even have a figure for it, but so this is sort of what you've seen before. It's our published work. With the PDGFRA ethanol interaction, where in an untreated mutant you have this missing of the midline cartilage here, and that's exacerbated in the mutant, but then you also reveal haploinsufficiency now in the heterozygote. And so I was contacted a little while ago by Max Monkey's lab, who they had gotten three different alleles of PDGFRA from patients that they had seen, and so we were testing them in zebrafish, the logic being that we inject the human form of PDGFRA and see if it can restore the phenotypes, the normal phenotype in a PDGFRA mutant, either in without alcohol or with alcohol, to see if then it's a loss of function. And so, again, the data very, very preliminary, but we have one allele that when Alfira injects that into now a PDGFRA tetrazygote and treats it with alcohol, she gets defects. And so that nothing happens if that embryo is untreated and that heterozygote that develops perfectly normally. And so we're super excited by that result, and we think that it will pan out, because then what that tells us, unless I'm thinking about it wrong, is that this variant that we're looking at would be dominant, but only in an ethanol-treated condition. So therefore, the human allele would potentially behave differently whether there was an alcohol exposure or not, and not just behaving differently, but dominantly. So we're really interested in following up on that. So Alfira is doing that. Hopefully that will see the light of day soon.
So then what we've been trying to do is sort out what's happening with this interaction. And so PDGFRA is a growth factor. It signals through this pathway, and Neil has shown, again, this is from the published work, that what it looks like alcohol is doing is attenuating this pathway downstream of the receptor. And so then when you take away signaling, like in that PDGFRA het, and add alcohol, now this pathway doesn't function well enough, and you end up with some sort of alcohol-related disorder. So we've been trying to sort this out genetically, and we've had some mixed results. Our first expectation was that, so PDGFRA has another receptor in that family, PDGFRB. So our first thought was that one way that we could further attenuate this pathway and maybe recapitulate what happens in the alcohol-treated mutants is to take away that other receptor. So this is the PDGFRA. There's no alcohol on any of these fish, so this is that midline defect that they normally have. Now we take away PDGFRB. If you have PDGFRA, they're perfectly normal. But now you take away both, and you have this much more severe phenotype, very similar to what we had seen in alcohol. But to our surprise, we looked at, and so I didn't mention it, but what happens in the alcohol-treated PDGFRA mutants is that these neural crest cells that make those facial structures die. And we didn't find that actually in the double. Even though that phenotype looks to recapitulate what we see in alcohol, it's not due to cell death. It's not the same mechanism as what alcohol is doing. And this is just a movie. And if you were an aficionado, these little cells right here are making that structure that's disrupted, and that's the oral ectoderm. So those cells should stick on there, and this is the eye, and they should extend out beyond the eye, and they're not doing that. So it's a completely different reason why we get the similar phenotype. So that prompted us then to really start looking downstream of PDGFRA. And we're using this CRISPR-Cas9 technique to make mutants in downstream targets of PDGFRA. And I'm showing you this. So this is really, as they say, an experiment that's so easy a PI could do it, because I actually did this. And so what you do, you just inject a guide RNA and this Cas9 protein. The guide RNA recognizes a stretch of DNA, and then the Cas9 makes a double-strand break. That those are highly mutagenic, and so then what you end up with are embryos in zebrafish, because of the way we do it. You end up with embryos that are a genetic mosaic of wild type and various mutant alleles. And so then what we do is we sequence the locus we're interested in, and this is what we're looking for, something like at that arrow, where the sequence looks very good up to it, and then it turns really poor, and that's because of the multiple alleles that are in there. You're sequencing all of the alleles at the same time. And this is, I kind of like this, the rainbow of colors, because what we usually do, you're trying to read what the mutant sequence might be underneath these peaks that you see here. But actually, this is so highly mutagenic that it's actually mostly mutant alleles, and so the predominant sequence you get out of it for at least some of these is actually the mutant. And so this is a mutation in BAX-B that you've heard about from Scott before. So this is a downstream component of mTOR, and we're really interested to see if this will suppress the teratogenesis of ethanol in a PDGFRA mutant, and it looks promising there. We have even more promising evidence for another member of the mTOR pathway, TSC1A. So this is a negative regulator of the pathway. We would predict then that if we take away an allele of TSC1A, that should be protective against the PDGFRA mutants. And so, again, it's sort of early days, but so far the data look good that we do actually have fewer defects in if you're heterozygous at both loci rather than if you're only heterozygous at the PDGFRA locus. So right now what we're doing is generating a lot more mutants in the mTOR pathway, some that we would anticipate would enhance the ethanol teratogenicity as well as others that should suppress it, so that we can now genetically dissect how ethanol is interacting with the PDGFRA pathway. So this now is a different mutant that came from our forward genetic screen. I think I brought it up once before, but work that my grad student Tim Kuka has been doing based on this mutant, I think, is giving us some further insight into what ethanol might be doing within the cell to enhance the phenotypes in not only this mutant, LRP13B, but also PDGFRA. So this is, LRP is a member of a large family of LRP genes. Their proteins act as co-receptors for many different signaling pathways, so PDGFRA being one of them, and sonic hedgehog, and another ethanol-sensitive mutant. And so this is the phenotype of these guys here. So you're looking, this is the jaw of the fish, and then you go more posterior cartilages, and basically these ventral structures here along the midline are disrupted when you put ethanol on these mutants. And so this was interesting to Tim, so that phenotype, and again, because these genes regulate signaling by other pathways, that phenotype looked a lot like a phenotype that you see when you disrupt this pathway, the FGF pathway. So here, this is a little inhibitor of the pathway. He can put that on at a dose that doesn't disrupt a heterozygous fish, but now you do that on the homozygote, it starts looking like an ethanol-treated mutant. And so this prompted Tim to take a look at other LRP pathways. So LRP2, this is an LRP that actually modulates sonic hedgehog signaling. It's duplicated in zebrafish, so hence you get this LRP2A and LRP2B. And basically what you have here are fish that lack three alleles of these genes. And they do have defects here in the absence of alcohol, but you add alcohol and they get substantially worse. So the ethanol sensitivity of the LRP pathway seems to extend beyond just LRP13B. We're interested in looking at other LRPs. But that brought Tim to this model, and this is, I think, one of the exciting things that is going on in the lab. So one of the things that these growth factor receptors do, they're sitting here, this is a cell membrane, they sit there at the surface, they respond to ligands, and they signal, but they're recycled through endocytosis. And there are different types of endocytic pits, ones that are clathrin-coated and ones that are caveolin-coated. And so what Tim thought, because the other aspect of this recycling endocytosis is that it actually modulates the signaling downstream of the receptor, being that the receptor will signal differently if it is incorporated into a clathrin-coated pit as opposed to a caveolin-coated pit. And that with PDGF, it's known to modulate its ability to signal through AKT and the mTOR pathway. And in liver, ethanol's been shown to disrupt the ability of receptor-mediated endocytosis towards the clathrin-coated pit specifically. So he thinks then that part of the teratogenicity of ethanol is this modulating receptor signaling capacity by disrupting which one of these endocytic pathways that receptor can enter. So chlorpromazine is a drug that you might be familiar with, but it acts similarly to ethanol here, blocking or reducing the ability of clathrin-coated endocytosis. So based on that model, then, chlorpromazine ought to act like alcohol. And that's, again, so early days here, but that is what he's finding, a dose of the drug that doesn't disrupt a wild-type fish causes a similar phenotype to alcohol in the, and it's cut off here. These are the LRP13B mutants. So then the real question is, does this apply to other signaling pathways? And so this is very new data, but that same drug causes an exacerbation of the PDGFRA mutant phenotype as well. And so we're exploring this as a possible mechanism. Tim wants to really get a look at the cells and see what's happening. We have an additional piece of evidence that suggests that this endocytic pathway might be part of what's happening in ethanol teratogenesis. So I did a small chemical screen. I was just looking for chemicals that interacted with alcohol. And so this little chemical here is a GSK3 inhibitor. I found it really exciting because depending upon the time that you treated fish with it, with or without alcohol, you had sort of differing responses. So here at an earlier time point, the drug or the chemical does not much by itself, but you add it to alcohol, you get an exacerbated phenotype. The opposite happens at a slightly different stage. So it has an effect on its own here that's actually ameliorated by alcohol. But so the reason that this might tie into Tim's model of endocytosis is that GSK3 is upstream in this sorting of receptors into endocytic pathways. So this may still be the same mechanism. So that's what we've learned with PDGFRA, with VANGL2.
Johan?
Yes.
Quick question before you go on. So this LRP story, it sounds like you're implicating various pathways, SONIC and PDGF and FGF. Have you looked at LRP 5 or 6, which would implicate Wnt signaling and may also tie into the GSK3 signaling as well?
Right. Right. I mean, yeah, excellent question, and that's on our radar. We haven't done that yet. We already had the LRP2 mutant, so that was a little easier for us to do, but we'll need to get our hands on those other mutants because, as you say, Wnt is already implicated in there, and GSK3 is in that pathway, so it would seem to be a strong candidate. Any other questions on that? Great.
Nope, thanks.
Okay. So then the VANGL2, this came out of one of our genetic screens, and this is kind of a busy data slide showing you the sensitivity of all of the different genotypes to cyclopia, ethanol-induced cyclopia. The real take-home here is that you have a very sensitive time window when mutants are most sensitive to ethanol, and that time window is actually different from when the heterozygotes are most sensitive to ethanol. So genotype can actually shift sensitive time windows, and we're not sure why that is, but Alfira
Yes.
Does it shift the development?
The
timing of development.
So in our hands, our fish are always a little slowed by ethanol, and so any of our analyses, we always have to be real careful that we're using the staging series here.
I thought you were. Okay.
Yeah, and for Alphira's RNA-seq data, then it has an important implication, because if you treat at 4 hours and then collect for something that would be a 6-hour embryo, that if it's been in alcohol, it's not actually that stage, and so we have to wait. So those fish are actually, more like 6.2 hours or something like that.
Yes.
So this is just part of her characterization. So what Bangle 2 does is regulate convergent extension, the lengthening of the body axis, and the narrowing as well. And so these are just for data, again, for controls and ethanol treated across the different genotypes. So here it really kind of, whereas the PDGFRA interaction still appears a peer synergy where you induce a death response here, it seems more additive that alcohol disrupts this process by itself. The mutation does as well, and it's probably some additive combination that then the embryo fails to get over some threshold and causes these eye defects. So what I brought up at our last meeting, that Alphira had initiated some RNA-seq studies, and so what she has data back now on this 1% alcohol, so that's in the media. That's our dose that for a wild type is subteratogenic, but it enhances mutant phenotypes. And so she's just taken a look at that. And I don't have all of the data to go through with you, but she's found looking at different time windows and alcohol versus not alcohol, she's found some ethanol-sensitive modules. And so this one was, I thought, of interest because this is what's called a KEG pathway, so this god-awful pathway of tons of genes that interact with one another. And we found it very interesting because this is actually the mTOR pathway. And so genes that show up red are upregulated in the mutants. Green, these are downregulated, and so this doesn't mean that they're statistically upregulated. That's not mapped on here yet, but that they in the overall data set they are up. So we're fairly interested, and again, this is the in an instance where ethanol would not have a teratogenic effect. So it seems like there's a lot of upregulation of this pathway potentially as a compensatory mechanism. And we could imagine then when you have a genetic hit to this pathway that disrupts the balance. And so then I thought I would end on just some of the BMP work. So Ben just published this. He got into this because of this phenotype here, where in particular BMP pathway mutants, you lose the lower jaw. And so part of what was in Ben's paper that he just published was the role of BMP signaling in that development, and he's now working on understanding what alcohol's doing. But basically, this is just a small molecule inhibitor of the BMP pathway. And this is actually the time window when BMP pathway mutants are sensitive to ethanol, so this is a sledgehammer on that pathway during this time, and it disrupts this. I'm not going to go through all the data. This defect is because the endoderm, which is required for proper facial development, is disrupted when you block BMP signaling. So what I did want to show you was these results here, where Ben is now looking at multiple alleles of the BMP pathway. So this is actually a ligand. This is a transcription factor that's important for downstream signaling of BMP.
And so basically here, if you have, if you're heterozygous for both of these alleles, both of these genes, you develop perfectly normal. But now when you take away an additional allele of BMP or of SMAD5, you have some defects here. All of these embryos are ethanol treated, but, and I don't have the untreated embryos here, but if you take my word for it, in the absence of ethanol, this genotype always looks like this. And in the absence of ethanol now, if you take away BMP4 and SMAD5, that genotype always looks like this. What happens now when you treat them with alcohol is you extend this into a phenotypic spectrum, this three allele combination that goes all the way from, you know, what an untreated compound genotype would look like all the way to what a double mutant looks like. So ethanol is just increasing this phenotypic variation then that's seen in these pathway mutants, and he's trying to understand that. And so based on some work from Jim Marr's lab with E-cadherin, Ben's actually looking into that. And so this is his newest data. So red, this is a transgenic RFP in the endoderm. Green is E-cadherin. This is a cell-cell adhesion molecule that's important for morphogenesis of epithelial structures. And again, in the preliminary data, it looks like the distribution of E-cadherin is greatly disrupted in an alcohol-treated this is not alcohol. This is, again, the dorsamorphin. And so now he's applying this to understand what alcohol might be doing to the endoderm. And so that's all of the genetics I had, but I did want to show a piece of Johan's data where he's trying to apply our genetics to behavior. And so he's been taking a look at different alcohol treatment windows in a fish line that we have that's useful for imaging, and he sees that this normal shoaling behavior, so this is a fish swimming around in a tank, and this little black line indicates when a video animated shoal of fish shows up and they move towards it, and that's what the graphs are showing you up here. And you do that with either of these ethanol treatments, and you disrupt that movement there. So our long-term goal is to now get into the brain of some of these fish, where we might find gene-alcohol interactions in this behavior. So that's what I had. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Any questions? All right, I'll start off with a very stupid, naive question. Some of these, you're looking at these facial development and this cartilage development, but some of these genes you mentioned play other roles in, like PDGF, RA, might be a cause of cancer, some mutants of that. The BMP might be involved in bone density. Now,
right.
all of these have been shown to be impacted in individuals with FAS. I mean, if you look at Deepak's data on carcinogenesis and some other people's data on that, and I forget who the woman was who did the bone density scan up in Canada, but she found that bone density was reduced. Do you think these genes may be responsible for those effects as well with alcohol? And again, it's totally naive.
It doesn't sound naive at all. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, genetically, we call that pleiotropic effects. I believe that is the case. Like BMP4, those mutants do have an increased incidence in cancer. So it's certainly something that you might imagine then in the scenario where you have, you know, an attenuation of that pathway, and now you add alcohol to further dampen it down, then that person will be more susceptible to developing cancer later on. So I do think that is probably the case. And then the timing of when the alcohol exposure probably becomes very important, you know, so PDGFRA has a role in oligodendrocyte development, but that might be a little later than its role in neural crest migration. So you could potentially end up with, depending upon the pattern of drinking, a lot of different phenotypes from the same genetic interaction.
Well, I think it also, it says that the work you're doing is important not only because of the facial phenotypes that may develop, but generally, you know, long-term consequences all across the board.
Right, you know. Yes. I believe you are correct.
Thank you.
Johan, I have a quick question. Could you go back to the stuff you're working on with Max, the PDGF? So you mentioned that it looked like the human variant that you made may be doing something, maybe acting differently, but maybe it's acting through a different pathway that is being activated by alcohol. You see what? So you remember I sent you that figure a couple weeks ago about linking the P53. Which we now know through Tatiana's work may be associated with the facial, that maybe activates those pathways is that this variant only works through that pathway when those pathways are activated by alcohol. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, no, I think,
may be right.
Yeah, that's actually sort of how we're thinking about it, that this mutation might be telling us about, you know, the differing functions of the receptor, and that somehow that mutation is really only disrupting this mTOR aspect of the pathway, and so in this one condition it behaves dominantly because that's when you need that function.
Yeah,
I think that is kind of how we're thinking about it, and so I think, you know, we may well learn some important stuff about not only alcohol teratogenesis there, but how this receptor signals differently in different contexts.
Yep. Cool.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I just got a suggestion, Johan. At some point a long time ago, Kathy was interested in looking at clathrin-coated pits and how alcohol affected those in, I guess, the whole embryo culture.
Okay.
And it was so you may want to reach out to her. I mean, it was in line with alcohol's effects on lipid RAS signaling, but I recall for some reason she also became interested in clathrin-coated pits.
Okay, yeah, thanks for that.
Maybe Scott has some insight, but...
Yeah, I vaguely remember that, and I don't remember why she didn't. I don't remember why, but we were going to look at the LRP, but then we got the mice, but they were infected with something, so we had to kill them. We got them from Germany, and we were going to do the same experiment that Johan was doing, and well, anyway, we just gave up. But I'm glad you're making it work.
Any other news? Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
any
I'm
other
good.
News that anyone wants to report? Okay. Dale, Bill? Everything good?
I think so. I'm glad everyone's applications got in. And I think Beata, Ed has been in touch with you in terms of potential reverse site visit weekend or weeks.
We have 2-week window that we have blocked out.
Okay.
And it's from
March 17th.
When did it start, Jill? March 4th or something?
March 6th.
Yes, all right. That week. Those 2 weeks have been blocked out for that site visit, and I know she's trying to put together a review committee, and I will say that we will have mock site visits via the web, and then probably to meet a day early to drill down and get to the nitty-gritty so that everybody's familiar with the process. This is not a show-and-tell. This is, here's what I showed you already, and do you have any questions that I can answer? So it's not a very long couple hours, and we're out of there. And hopefully we'll know our scores within a day or two, if not sooner.
Ed, I'm sorry if I've missed this, but do we have a call scheduled to discuss?
We will be setting up several calls. I have to talk to certain people who I want to look over all of the grants or some of them and come up with what they believe are key questions that a reverse site visit team might ask and go from there. But we will be having conference calls.
Ed, it's Michael. Do we have a sense of when the date will get fixed? How far from the present?
No.
It will be until we actually know and can plan
around
that.
I asked, and she said that one of the problems is finding reviewers that we don't have conflicts with, even though they're being very lenient on what they consider a conflict. But she said that she would let me know as soon as possible, so that we could narrow it down to, you know, a 2-day period.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah.
I do know she's actively working on that and wants to have the review panel set as soon as possible. So I think that will help with the advance notice.
Yeah, she has several large reviews she's working on. So
right.
I think she has the India or the Centers reviews also, and that she's scheduling them, I think, a little bit later, so I think ours is probably going to be the first one. But all of these have to get done before council meets, so.
Right.
Good. I don't want to bother her, but I will pose that question, you know, right after the holidays. But, to see if we got a little narrowing of the window. So, anything else? Science Advisory Board members?
No, I'm good.
I'm good.
Okay, and NIAAA or Michael, any other comments?
Nothing else.
Okay, Scott, you have to get that paper in for Kathy's thing. Just to remind you.
Yes, I'm working on that now. I was waiting for...
I was bugged a little bit about several things when I was away, so I got to trying to put some pressure on to get all the stuff done. All right. Okie doke. Thank you very much, and we'll be in touch, and we'll talk again.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye.
Happy holidays.
Bye. Happy holidays.
Happy holiday to you, too. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed.
Bye-bye. Bye.